Good evening and welcome to this class on the Book of Ecclesiastes. I'm Jerry Weirwill, and it's my pleasure to be able to be with you this evening and go through this wonderful book in the Old Testament. As we start our journey into the Book of Ecclesiastes, there's some helpful background information that I want to share with you that I think will assist in properly setting the context for how we begin to understand this book. The first thing is that Ecclesiastes in the Old Testament is a wisdom literature book. It's unlike any other book in the Old Testament canon. And as part of the wisdom literature genre, it's unique in presenting a certain approach. And that's actually unique among the wisdom literature books themselves. The wisdom literature books being the books of Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and the Song of Songs. Nevertheless, there are definitely some aspects of Ecclesiastes that we will see that are shared among the other wisdom literature, especially the book of Proverbs. For example, there are proverbial sayings in the book of Ecclesiastes, and these sayings sound very similar to some of those that are in the book of Proverbs. And we'll encounter at least one of them here in this first section tonight in chapter 1. As wisdom literature, we must be cautious not to read Ecclesiastes as if it was some other type of literature. I say this at the outset here because the genre of the literature influences how we approach the text. Ecclesiastes is not a historical narrative book. It doesn't entail prophecy or law. And so we would read it as wisdom literature and not approach it and think in terms of these other genres. Wisdom literature is designed to influence the way a person thinks. It's meant to be persuasive and motivational. And to that end, it will often generalize things. It will overstate things. It will omit and exclude things, and even sometimes apparently contradict itself. These are all strategies of wisdom literature in an attempt to formulate a specific way of thinking in the mind of the reader. And so wisdom literature will often paint things in very black and white terms and give like a very stark view of reality that might seem off-putting, but it's meant to motivate the reader to choose between, for example, A versus B, where the matter in reality tends to be far more complex and there are many more shades of gray in between. Now, the second thing is how to approach this book. We talked about the genre being wisdom literature, but in the wisdom literature, it's not like Proverbs. It doesn't just give little, small, pithy sayings. It has larger chunks and sections. I think it's helpful to explain Ecclesiastes as sort of like notes of a journal that were kept, and that it's the reflections of a person upon their life. We know that Ecclesiastes contains the observations on life. We know that it records the attitudes and feelings of the author as he searches for the meaning of life. And we know that it sets forth his conclusions after a lifetime of searching. We could also perhaps think of Ecclesiastes maybe as like a travel log in this way, or a guidebook perhaps, that was left after a traveler has gone down an itinerary and has then left what he has discovered for the next person who intends to travel that same path. And so it contains these uncensored observations about one man's learnings of life that was lived to the fullest with no avenue or pursuit left unexplored. The man who wrote Ecclesiastes has done it all. He simply lives to tell it through Ecclesiastes to the reader. Another important point about how to approach Ecclesiastes is that Ecclesiastes is very androcentric. What I mean by androcentric is that it's very male-oriented. It presents things from a male point of view. There are very male-specific references in it. It's from a man who clearly, as we will see, has a lot of power and authority, is able to basically do anything that he wants unrestrained. He has relationships with women. He occupies himself with male-oriented tasks. according to ancient customs and omits obvious female-oriented tasks and activities according to ancient customs, such as there's no mention of birthing children, child-rearing, home-caring, or cooking, and other things that were common of females in the ancient culture. But this has nothing to do with whether or not the book is applicable to both men and women. It simply just needs to be understood that this is the perspective from which the author is writing. Now, before we talk about the overall structure and layout of the book, I'd like to address perhaps one glaringly obvious question, and that is, why is the book called Ecclesiastes? And what does that word even mean? The title Ecclesiastes is actually the Greek title given to the book in the Greek translation of the Old Testament, called the Septuagint. And this was done in somewhere in the 3rd century BC. Actually, in our English Bibles, most of the titles of the Old Testament books come through to us from the Greek translation of the Septuagint. Now, before we talk about the word Ecclesiastes, let's take one more step back, roughly in time, to the Hebrew text. The title Ecclesiastes is translated from the Hebrew word Koheleth. Now, this Hebrew word, it roughly means one who calls together or gathers an assembly, or it could also be one who is addressing or speaking to an assembly. And likewise, this is what the word Ecclesiastes means too. It means one who gathers an assembly or one who speaks to or addresses an assembly. The word Ecclesiastes has in it the root word ekklesia that many of us might be familiar with. It's a common New Testament word for church or congregation or assembly. And in the Old Testament, it's used for the congregation of Israel or the people of Israel. And an Ecclesiastes is the person who gathers the ekklesia or speaks to the ekklesia. I want to read a passage from the book of Deuteronomy. In Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 9 and 10 here, this is Moses speaking to the people of Israel. He says, "Take heed to yourself and guard your soul closely, lest you forget all the things that your eyes have seen, and let them not be far from your heart all the days of your life. And you shall direct your sons and your sons' sons about the day when you stood before the Lord your God at Horeb, on the day of the assembly, the ekklesia, from the Septuagint, when the Lord said to me, 'Assemble.'" Now, this direction, assembling, is the verb form of Ecclesiastes. And so he is to Ecclesiastes, the people here, to him, to the Lord, "and let them hear my words so they may learn to fear me all the days as long as they live on the earth and may teach their sons." Moses was an Ecclesiastes to Israel. That's what this passage is showing us. He had the task of both gathering together the people of Israel and speaking to them and teaching them what Yahweh was instructing them to do. And this is alike what the author of Ecclesiastes sees as his responsibility as well, to pass along his lifelong accumulation of learning and understanding about the meaning of life. Many English Bibles translate the Hebrew word Koheleth, or Kohelet, as the preacher. And it's entirely possible that both the meanings of gathering the assembly and addressing the assembly can be present. And so one who preaches, addresses, and speaks to them, not so much gathers the assembly. And so I think, though, when what we see in Ecclesiastes is it's not so much gathering together people as much as it is gathering together wisdom and understanding and then delivering it to the reader, who is essentially the assembly. There are many different other translations, such as teacher and philosopher and speaker for Koheleth. But given the context of Ecclesiastes, it seems that perhaps maybe somebody who is deeply saturated in wisdom and someone who has just a very in-depth knowledge and experience of life, that perhaps the translation sage might more entail that idea. And so throughout this class, I'm going to be referring to the author of Ecclesiastes as the sage. And this is the rendering that we've chosen to go with in the Revised English Version Bible, which I will be reading from throughout the class. So who wrote Ecclesiastes? Well, in verse 1, we don't find a name of anyone as the author. We find the title, the sage. But we know a few things about this individual. We do know he's a man. We know the sage is masculine. And he's described to be the king of Jerusalem. If it's Solomon, then he would be the third king of Israel. And we know that he was not just a king in Israel. We know that he was a son of David, which Solomon would also fit. And Solomon is the traditional author of Ecclesiastes. The author considers himself to be the wisest man. He also is a great builder. He was extremely wealthy, and he had a large harem. All of these characteristics really aptly describe King Solomon in the Old Testament, who was a son of David, the third king of Israel in Jerusalem. But some scholars have noted that there are a couple factors that militate against this, including that there's a shift from first person to third person, suggesting the possibility of a narrator or a composer of the book, much kind of like the way the gospel writers preserved the teachings of Jesus, but Jesus himself wasn't the author of those books. But whether Solomon was the direct author or perhaps a later editor, narrator compiled the writings in their final form, it still seems best to identify the sage as Solomon. And so throughout the class, for the sake of convention, I'm going to be referring to the author of Ecclesiastes as Solomon. And we're not going to get stuck on the details of the potential discrepancy of the authorship. We'll leave that out of the class for another day and another time. Now, Solomon, being the wisest person in the world, this is conveyed in the book of 1 Kings. In 1 Kings chapter 3, it says, "The king Solomon went to Gibeon to sacrifice there, for that was the great high place. Solomon offered 1,000 burnt offerings on that altar. At Gibeon, Yahweh appeared to Solomon in a dream by night and said, 'Ask what I should give you.' And Solomon said, 'You've shown to your servant David, my father, great covenant faithfulness, because he walked before you in truth and in righteousness and in uprightness of heart with you. You've kept this great covenant faithfulness to him by giving him a son to sit on his throne as it is this day. Now, Yahweh, my God, you've made your servant king instead of David, my father. Yet I'm a young lad. I do not know how to go out or come in. Your servant is in the midst of your people that you have chosen, a great people that are too many to be numbered or counted. So give your servant an understanding heart to judge your people, that I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to judge this great people of yours?' And the word was good in the eyes of the Lord, that Solomon had asked this thing. God said to him, 'Because you have asked this thing and have not asked for yourself for a long life, nor have asked riches for yourself, nor have asked for the life of your enemies, but have asked for discernment for yourself to understand justice. Behold, I have done according to your words. Behold, I've given you a wise and discerning heart, so that there has been none like you before you and after you. None will arise like you. I've also given you what you've not asked for, both riches and honor, so that there will not be anyone among the kings like you all your days. And if you will walk in my ways, keeping my statutes and my commandments as your father David walked, then I will lengthen your days." What a request by Solomon as he ascends to the throne in Israel, that out of everything he could have asked for in life, he asked for wisdom. If you could ask God for anything, what would it be? Would you ask God for wisdom like Solomon did? Well, in Ecclesiastes, it depends on who wrote Ecclesiastes to determine the date of composition. If you go with King Solomon as the direct author, then an early date of somewhere in the 10th century, somewhere like 930 or so, 935, because Solomon reigned up until 931 when he died approximately. But if it's a later post-exilic date, it could be anywhere from the 5th century down to the late 2nd century BC. I'd like to give just a general overview of Ecclesiastes, kind of like a map just what we're going to be looking at in this class before we get started diving into chapter one. Ecclesiastes doesn't actually begin the way that one might think it would. It doesn't really start from the beginning and go from there. Solomon states at the beginning his overall conclusion from the investigation. He then sets out throughout the book how he arrived at that conclusion. This is not really surprising, I suppose. This is a common storytelling technique where you will have some sort of a description of a present circumstance, and then all of a sudden you'll have a flashback. This happens in movies all the time. You'll have some scene where they will show you something that's happening, and then all of a sudden they'll cut, and there'll be a line, 7 years earlier. And what they'll do is they will then progress from there back up to the place that the movie started to explain how things came to be. It's exactly what Solomon's doing here. So being, I guess in modern filmmaking, that being some sort of an artistic move, that's what they were doing 3,000 years ago. The outline I've presented in your notes there, I'm not going to go through it in detail, but this is just a general outline of the book where there's an introduction here where we'll deal with verses 1 through 11. And then the beginning of Solomon's exploration begins in chapter 1, verse 12, and goes all the way through the book to chapter 12, verse 7. And then the ending of the book has a little tag, I could call it an epilogue, where Solomon explains what he has learned and the meaning behind his conclusion and how his perspective is supposed to affect the reader and the way that they look at life. It might seem in Solomon's eyes that life is long and sort of like very bleak, but life's really not that long. It might seem that way, but the more you live, the more you realize that the seasons of life, they kind of come and go like a breath. And this is a theme that Solomon will relate to, is this idea of very transient or very like things that are fleeting and not long lasting. And if you'd ask somebody to look back on their life like Solomon is doing, probably they'd most likely say that, well, it seemed like yesterday that, and they would talk about something that happened 2 decades ago. Time in life seems to somehow be telescopic, where things that are very far in the past are not so distant in our memory because time sort of collapses on itself a lot of times in our memory. There's a major theme of Ecclesiastes about the meaning of life, and Solomon sets out right in the beginning, and he sets out his main premise that everything is pointless. This pointlessness of life is going to come up time and time again as it applies to Solomon's investigation. This Hebrew word that is translated pointless, it really just means something that is like a breath or something that's like it's like a vapor. It's there one moment, and then the next, it's gone. And there's a few different nuances that this Hebrew word takes throughout the book of Ecclesiastes. But for the sake of consistency, the translation of pointless has been used on almost all occurrences. Solomon's conclusion is that whatever humans amount to, whatever activity they are involved in, whatever ambitions they pursue, they actually amount to nothing in the end. Life is just a repetition of cycles of events. It doesn't have any actual lasting value or satisfaction, and it's impossible to control and to direct. But Solomon's frame of thinking in this regard includes the perspective of all this human activity from simply a earthly point of view. What the phrase he will use is under the sun. Many people have understood the issue that Solomon has raised and have tried to propose alternate ways to understand meaning and purpose in life. This is the task that philosophers like to apply themselves to try and solve. And lots of philosophies have been developed to try to explain the meaning and purpose of life under the sun, but none of them really truly offer a satisfying answer. In a quick preview of some of the most predominant philosophies that have been set forth to explain the meaning and purpose of life under the sun, We have natural pantheism, which says that we're supposed to care for nature. Theism, which would be Christianity and Judaism, to follow God's will. Following Taoism, to follow the way, but no one can tell you what it is. Determinism, accept that everything is predetermined. Confucianism, fulfill your duties to others. Mohism, love people impartially. Solipsism, since only you exist, you know it, you know the meaning. Cynicism, be self-sufficient. Hedonism, have pleasure. Platonism, acquire maximum knowledge. Legalism, get practical skills. Epicureanism, free yourself from pain. Quietism, asking this question leads to more confusion. Aristotelianism, be a good person. Stoicism, be dispassionate. Modern humanism, act in the self-interest and common good. Subjectivism, life's meaning is different for each person. Liberalism, defend individual liberty. Kantianism, do as you'd have others do. Nihilism, do as you wish. Life has no meaning. Pragmatism, bring more value to humans. Positivism, life has no meaning until you give it one. Existentialism, make decisions and be positive. Absurdism, stop trying to find a meaning, just live. And so on and so forth. I'm pretty sure there will be no end to people trying to figure out meaning and purpose for life under the sun. So let's go to the beginning of the book of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes chapter 1. The words of the sage, the son of David, king in Jerusalem, utterly pointless, says the sage. Utterly pointless. Everything is pointless. What does a man gain from all his toil at which he toils under the sun? I've mentioned that the word pointless is the Hebrew word hevel, and here it's repeated multiple times. He's basically driving this point home in the highest degree possible. In the Hebrew, it's like the greatest expression you could make about this matter. It's the pointlessness of pointlessnesses. And so he's basically, this is his major conclusion here. This is the what he has discovered after all of his searching. He lays it out right now. He says, everything is pointless. There's other meanings of the Hebrew word hevel for pointless. It can also mean futile. Some translations might go with meaningless or worthless or something like maybe incomprehensible, absurd, temporary, fleeting, non-lasting, beyond one's grasp, even counter-rational. All these nuances are part and parcel of that picture. But as I said, we're going to be sticking with the word pointless, and we're going to understand a little bit more about those nuances in the different ways that it's used as we come across them. Now, this is a metaphorical use of the meaning of something that's like a breath or a vapor. Here one minute, not the next. If it basically just comes and goes, it's almost like it's never been there and therefore doesn't have actually any impact, no actual effect, hence pointless. What Solomon does next in verse 3, he then offers his major premise for his investigation. What does a man gain from all his toil, which he toils under the sun? I mentioned under the sun as a reference to the earthly sphere of existence. Things that are happening that you can see around you under the sun. This phrase comes up many, many times throughout the book. But the focus here of the question is the word gain. What does a man gain from all his toil at which he toils under the sun? The idea is that it's about what can you actually have that's a lasting difference. What can you have that actually makes life somehow one step higher than what it was before? This seems to be a little bit pessimistic from the outset. He's basically saying he's found that the answer is nothing. So it's like, wow. I mean, if you don't scratch your head, kind of like, is he living a good life here? Or is he just like, you know, nonstop hardship? Why does he have such a bad, negative outlook on life? You'd think that that wouldn't be the case for the king of Israel, the wisest man alive, who had more wealth than anyone else, but that is what he is going to come to. And the reason for it deals with this idea of perspective. Solomon is doing this investigation from a particular perspective. He's looking at all the activity, and we'll go through it through the class. He goes and he does all these little experiments in life to try to discover, is there something that actually gives a person a real benefit, a step up, something that actually advances the existence of a human existence? You can think of it as he's going to be trying to test the purely human level of existence. What he comes to, what he says is that no matter how great your life is, no matter how wonderful, how successful, how famous, how much you gain, how much you do, all of it will, in the end, be pointless. Why is that? Because activity in and of itself, according to Solomon, will not be able to produce any lasting and ultimate value. So that lays the groundwork for what we're going to be pursuing in the book of Ecclesiastes, with the conclusion of everything is pointless and the question, can a person gain anything in life from the activity that they do under the sun?